Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. Today's a very special day in the kingdom. Why do you ask? Well, it's Wes Craven's birthday. And to celebrate the birthday of our king, we're going to take a bit of a detour down the lane to an unmade sequel to what I would say is his darkest film. Today, we are going to be talking about the unmade sequel to The Last House on the Left. He did write a script, and we're going to get into that later. We are joined today by a very special returning guest judge. We have with us Samantha White. She was with us previously on an episode about Bride of Frankenstein, and we're very excited to have her back. Sam, how's it going?
Hello. I am so excited to be here. Thank you for having me again.
Oh my God, we're so excited to have you back. For those that don't know, which is probably most people, Sam is one of my best friends in the entire world and frequent creative collaborator. Would you agree with both of those titles?
I would agree with both of those titles. I think they are equally indicative of my abilities and what I bring to this world.
For those that maybe don't remember you, and how dare they, can you do me a favor of reintroducing yourself to the Development Hell audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a writer, editor.
Very good at reining in my writing and a very beautiful creative on her own right. So Sam, you know, we brought you in for a pretty dark topic today. I'm just wondering, before we get into the nitty-gritty, what is your personal relationship with The Last House on the Left?
Well, could I start you with my personal relationship to Wes Craven? Because I found something else out when I was looking through, when I was doing a little scroll through his filmography. Would you like to know or guess the first Wes Craven movie that I ever saw?
Oh my God, I absolutely would love to guess because I don't know. Okay, so there's going to be a lot of cat factors to consider, like your age, our era, when you were what? Okay, so I'm going to say this is probably
I think I'm going to also help you. And okay, I'm going to say that it's worth knowing or worth remembering, because you know this, Joshua, my friend, but of course the audience doesn't know this, that I also only watched the entire Scream franchise within the last year.
I was not going to guess Scream. I was not. Oh, I think I got it. I think I have it.
But I probably don't. But if I do, it's very funny. Music of the Heart.
No, but I wish. I did see that and was so confused.
Because I don't think a lot of these old-timer horror directors were comfortable with their horror label.
Right.
And that was where that came from. Okay, so not... I really wish I was right with that one, but I'm not. Okay, do I get one more shot?
You get one more shot, and I believe same era. I could be walking you down the wrong path, but I believe same era.
Holy... Oh, okay. I have it. One more guess. I've got one more goose in the boost. And that is it called Vampire in Brooklyn with Eddie Murphy?
I think it is, but was not it.
All right, what is it?
It was, of course, Red Eyes, starring Rachel McAdams and Cillian Murphy. I saw that in theaters. I will never forget the pen stab in the trachea. It'll stay with me forever. So thank you.
Is the trachea like your collarbone?
It's like your esophagus area, I believe. Maybe it's into the esophagus, but I thought it was trachea.
And she got him, right?
Yes, she gets him. Yes, because she realizes while on this plane that he's been kind of like stalking her and all that. No, I enjoyed Red Eye, to be honest with you.
Oh, Red Eye, I believe. Like, well-loved classic.
Canadian Queen.
As
we're going to talk about more. Oh, no. Are they? Sarah Paxton's not Canadian. She just does a ton of Canadian stuff. Right?
I don't think she's Canadian, but I think I told you blatantly that she was Canadian.
That sounds right.
I think Martha McIsaac is
Yes, she is.
And we are going to get into her a little bit. So that was your first relationship with Wes Craven, Red Eye, pretty classic. Ooh, do I get to say my first relationship with Wes Craven now that we're getting into
it? Absolutely, you should. Oh, you're toasting the king on his birthday.
Happy birthday, King. We love you. I don't know, to be honest with you. It's probably Scream. Might have been A Nightmare on Elm Street. I'm guessing one of those first two. I think I saw Scream pretty early.
That would make sense for our childhood, our era.
Our oeuvre. I mean, the first
our
horror
era,
movie.
Our oeuvre. Yeah,
era, our oeuvre, our ourselves. I think the first, I know the first horror movie I ever saw was I Know What You Did Last Summer. Fans of this podcast might remember me saying that many times.
Yeah. I don't think I knew that was your first one, to be honest with you.
It was, yes. Uh-huh. And I think it says a lot. So we love Wes Craven. I think we'll talk about him a little bit more down the lane. But I'm wondering, with this movie, had you seen it before we tackled it for this episode?
So I had seen the original version once, about a year ago. And I mean, I don't know how much we want to go into it yet, but I surprisingly really... I don't want to say really liked it for a movie like this, because I feel like that's a little...
Problem in the attic.
Yes. Problem in the attic. Absolutely. And there are no flowers in there.
None. They're dead.
But yes. So I enjoyed the film more than I was expecting to, certainly.
And I remember that.
Yeah. We fought about it a little bit.
I was going to ask you to bring it up, and I am just so proud of you for doing that on your own accord. Yeah. So what was my reaction when you came to me, your horror friend, as a non-horror person yourself, and said, I saw Last House on the Left and I liked it?
Well, I think you were surprised. And then I think, like, we were talking about it. We were getting into the reasons of why I appreciated it, if not liked it. It's also very, side note, it's very fascinating to look at the Letterboxd reviews for this movie. I don't know if you did.
I've never had.
They are all like 3.5, 4.5 stars, or half star or one star. Like, they are
Polar.
Is so polarized, which makes a lot of sense, obviously.
Yep.
This
is the polar vortex.
Yeah, so I think you were surprised that I liked it. I think I went at you with like a, well, you haven't seen it since you were 12. Maybe you should watch it again. And then you did not love me telling you to approach a horror movie again. So, which is fair.
How dare a non-horror person, give me feedback, right? Like, how dare that be your
movie? Well, of course, feedback in general. I mean,
not appreciated.
No.
And I think part of my appallment was that, A, like, I'm your horror person. I'm your man, you should be coming to me for recommendations, and you're not, which is like, okay.
I do. I watch a lot of horror stuff with you.
And then what made it worse is, it's like, this is what you're picking? Like, out of all of the classiques, out of all of the fun, like, iconic...
Well, I like fun. I had been, to be fair, I had been doing a run of, like, very early slashers that are super fun, super campy, and I was loving those, too.
Yeah, but they're always a little off-kilter in ways that I don't appreciate. Like, Sleepaway
Camp. That's what I like about them.
No. But that's okay. We're all our own men. We're all our own women.
Listen, I don't... I acknowledge the issues inherent in both of those movies, of which there are many. Okay. But I think that... I mean, Last House on the Left more so than Sleepaway Camp. I'm not going to say this for Sleepaway Camp. But I think, like... At least with Last House on the Left, I found the lens to be correct. I found that, like, what was trying to be said and shown was that was being done effectively. And I think that that is what got me. I mean, beyond the 90-minute runtime or less than 90-minute runtime, which you know I'm a sucker for.
And who isn't? It's just such a beautiful gift to your audience.
It is.
I agree with you on some fronts, and I disagree with you on other fronts. I have to say, I stand proudly with my 12-year-old self still after this rewatch. This is not the reason I'm coming to horror movies. Like, nothing fun is going on here. There is a lot of mean-spiritedness afoot. And the satisfaction that I think, you know, presents itself with the final act is just not the satisfaction I'm seeking in my genre. So I think it's not so much a fact of I don't think this is a good film, because I think it's kind of hard to argue that it's not. It's just, it's just truly not for me.
A difference for me is I'm not necessarily, I knew I wasn't coming into this to have fun, for sure. Like, this wasn't me showing up to, like, a theater for, like, an experience in the same way that I would with, like, or that I did even to go see Nope last week.
Yeah, the genre's precious for me, and that's why I'm, like, looking for it to not truly tear me in half. And I think when it does, it's kind of like, I don't know, this is going too far. I think it's going too far for me. This film goes too far for me. It teeters in the world of, like, true exploitation. And that just, like, I stop enjoying myself. And I stopped enjoying myself, you know, right away in this film.
Yeah.
And then that long, prolonged segment in the woods where he makes her pee herself, and you know it's going to be as bad as possible. And none of these people, like, I like to like my villains. I think one of the reasons why Craven's, like, one of his most successful works, or actually all of his successful works, you root for the villain. You love Freddy. You love even Ghostface. These are charismatic characters. Like, these are people that you can root for even though they're doing terrible things. And that just doesn't happen with Last House on the Left.
Yeah, maybe this is a good movie, but it's not like a good horror movie, if that makes sense. Like, it is a good horror movie, but, like, it's not doing the things necessarily that a horror movie should do to be what a horror movie is.
Yeah, I actually, it doesn't even feel like a horror movie to me.
Yeah.
It doesn't have any of the beats. There's no spookiness. There's no jump scare. There's really no, like, you know, that level of atmosphere. It's just kind of like gritty realism followed by atmosphere. Violence.
Yeah.
There was atmosphere, yes, but not like a not like a spooky,
not ambiance.
Yeah,
atmosphere,
yeah.
But not ambiance. Maybe I don't know if that's not ambiance.
My friend Samantha, would you mind if I gave a bit of a seminar on the original Last House on the Left?
I would absolutely love nothing more than for you to do that.
So for people at home that need a bit of a reminder, Last House on the Left is from 1972, and as I was saying, it is an exploitation horror film from our dear friend Wes Craven, who wrote, directed, and edited this project as his very first film. Did you know this was his very first feature.
I did mm-hmm. know it was his very first feature, but I did not know that he did the whole kit and caboodle.
He did. Even edited it. Yes, he did, which is interesting. He produced it alongside Sean S. Cunningham, and that is another very iconic name in the landscape of horror. This is the guy that brought us the first Friday the 13th film. So this is an interesting early collaboration between two people that would go on to be maybe the most influential voices in 80s horror. The film follows our character of Mary Collingwood, as played by Sandra Peabody. She is what I believe is supposed to be depicting as a fairly average hippie teenager of her generation. She goes out with one of her friends on the eve of her birthday and runs into a group of, like, savage criminals who abduct them, take them to the woods, torture them, humiliate them, rape them, and brutally murder them. After this ordeal, by the luck of God, they find their way to Mary's house, where they spend the night, and Mary's parents realize that they have murdered their daughter, and they brutally murder the four of them, or I think the three of them, maybe even just two of them, I'm not 100% certain.
I think one dies kind of early, and then the boy? Rest are murdered. Yeah.
Who kills himself, I think, right? Shoots himself in the head.
Oh, does he? I forgot.
Well, his Krug is like, shoot yourself in the head, and then I think he does, so that was sad.
Oh, yeah. It is very sad. Much more effective than what they do with sad emo boy in the remake.
Yeah. I'm so excited to talk to you about the remake, because I assigned you to rewatch it, and I haven't seen it since 2009, but I remember really enjoying it. I'm excited for your thoughts. So, yeah, that's the basic rundown for what this film was about. Craven has said on multiple occasions that the inspiration for this is the 1960s Swedish film The Virgin Spring, directed by who else? Ingmar Bergman. And it has a very similar setup. Basically, I don't know, to my understanding, it's exactly the same. Although I do believe the young, innocent member of the gang gets like terribly, brutally murdered in that one. So, yeah, Craven originally wrote this screenplay to be overtly pornographic. And I believe Wes Craven actually comes from a background of pornography. Like he had directed porn prior to this. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah. Our dear friend cut his teeth, shall we say, in the porno biz. And you kind of see it with this movie.
You definitely see it, at least in the, I mean, for obvious mm-hmm. reasons you see it, but also in the very, like, guerrilla 70s vibe of it all.
Mm-hmm. Where everything just kind of looked like porn back then. It's kind of mm-hmm. impossible not to.
Exactly.
Yeah. Though when they were going to camera and when they were auditioning their actors, they made a conscious choice to change it to just strict horror. And I think that was a good move. Yeah. This movie was kind of bad for Wes Craven's career early on. It did make a good deal of money. Or not a good deal, but it did make money. But it was so controversial, specifically because of its marketing, that it became difficult for Craven after this to get new work. I think the tagline for the film was, "Can a movie go too far?" Which is kind of genius. So yeah, this movie made 3 million buckaroonos and only cost about $90,000 to make. Yeah, so this must have been one of the most profitable horror films when it came out and went on to become a bit of a classic. It got bad reviews, though. People were really confused about the intercutting of slapstick comedy with, like, brutal scenes of humiliation and rape. How do you feel about that?
Another thing that unfortunately really worked for me.
What?
Yes, it did. It did. Because, well, A, part of the reason it worked was because the big doofuses in this movie, the people that we're laughing at mostly, are the cops, are those stupid cop characters. Yes.
Very funny.
It actually gives this whole, like, this whole misconnections, oh, if someone had just seen, it gives it some more weight because it actually, like, gives the callousness of people, like, it grounds it in something that's not just like, oh, if the butterfly wings had fluttered differently. It's like, no, most of the right time there. When the shit happens,
it's
a million people who could have prevented it that are not just like passing narrowly by. They're staring right at it. Like,
yeah. And like either purposely ignoring or just like so incompetent that there's no way they can do anything. Yeah.
So I thought that just disjointedness of tone kind of like, yeah, I don't know. It worked for me. Again, I would maybe go back to my argument of like, I think it's maybe what makes it a good movie, but not a good horror movie. Because
I actually love that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's creating something like visceral and I don't know. It's doing something interesting, even if it's not giving us the feeling that we want.
I have to say, I agree with you when it comes to the cop stuff. Like the slapstick comedy with the cops is effective. And it really highlights the political POV of this film. I just didn't appreciate it when it came to, you know, the rape and the murder. Like, it just was, it made it extra strange and almost, like, a little less respectful, even, of these characters. Oh, I loved the girls, though. Maybe that is part of why I said I didn't love anyone in this movie. That's not true. The two hippie girls, I don't know. They're just so lovely.
And their naturalism, I find, like...
Yeah.
Our girlies, Martha and Sarah, did a great job, but I feel like these original girls, the realism, the innocence isn't put on by like a close up on like her tank top as she's changing. It's like the innocence and the realism of like those two young girls is like very felt, I think, and that's part of what makes it so effective.
And they're not like working actors. I'm assuming like they're just kind of seem like. Probably real people. Well, I'm not saying Martha McIsaac is like Hollywood royalty, but they are clearly, you know, union actors, Sarah and Martha.
Absolutely. Yes.
Which makes
raised
it a little
raised on sets, for sure.
Raised on sets and made it feel like it was just a little less dangerous, a little more contained. So, which is maybe why I liked the remake more. You know, it did feel more like a movie, and that made it, less dangerous for me.
Oh, see, that's why I liked it less. That's exactly why I liked it less. Do you want to hear my... Fair. This could be... You could save this for later if you want me to redo it. But just because it goes into an analogy. But do you want to hear my analogy?
Yeah, I'd love it.
So at first when I was watching this remake, and again, you can take me back if we need to, I was like, okay, this is like the Disney animated version of the Grimm fairy tale. Like we are seeing like the like bubbly like cartoon. We are seeing like everything work out in the world. Everyone's POV and intentions who we're supposed to care about are in the right place. We know that she is wounded and they're all sad because of the sun dying, and thus it makes sense that their wounds would be even fresher, that they'd be driven to this at this time. So at first I thought, okay, this is like the Disney animated version of like the originals, like Grimm fairy tale. But then I thought, no, this is the Disney live action version because it's trying to correct things in weird ways, but its POV isn't fully correct. It's so glossy. It's a bit uncanny, but it's doing all the, it's still telling the same story, but everything is a little weirdly off.
It's a little wonky and just not quite working and a little too gloss.
Exactly. And a little too, like, 2020 energy.
And, like, getting TV budget, not movie budget, ultimately.
Exactly. Yes.
That's funny. While I have not revisited the remake since 2009, something about that sounds very possible. Yeah. Hilarious. I'd like to revisit it now. That makes me want to watch it more. I remember there being a song in the trailer for the remake that I was absolutely obsessed with. It was by a band called Taken by Trees, and it was this like indie girly cover of Sweet Child of Mine. Did they play it in the film? Does that sound familiar?
I don't think so, no.
Oh, it's so good. And what, remember that song with the whistling from when we were in university? Something Bjorn and... It doesn't matter.
Oh, like Home? Oh, no, no. Yes, I know what you mean.
I think she was in that band. Mm. Since we're in the territory of the remake, I want to know a little bit more about it. Am I right to say this was Martha McIsaac and Sarah Paxton in the roles of the girls? Do you remember any of the other, like, did anyone else look familiar to you?
Oh my gosh, everyone. So the funniest thing about this movie, it came out 2009, right? Yes, 2009. Yeah. And it is like a who's who of like 2010s-ish TV stars. We've got Aaron Paul, who Breaking Bad started just a year before that. So, and he gets the death in the movie, I think, like the big one.
The microwave?
The carburetor.
Okay.
It takes him a long time. The microwave is our main last guy. Shot. Yeah. Our Garrett Dillahunt. Oh, uh-huh. Boy. I always want to say Garrett Hedlund, and I know it's not. I know it's not Garrett Hedlund. Anyway,
I believe you.
Monica Potter is our mommy.
Okay, I see Sarah Paulson in my brain.
No, so Monica Potter is from 2010's Parenthood, the TV show Parenthood. So that is where she came in, and she's doing what she does best, which is her big eyes well up with tears out of fear for her daughter's safety and overall happiness. That is what that woman does best.
Good for her.
And then there's Tony Goldwyn as the dad who played the president on Scandal in 2012. So these were all, this was like right as these like TV people who were all honestly probably nominated for Emmys within like a couple years of this. we're in this movie. And then of course I'm a big comedy person. So I love seeing Ricky Lindholm in there. Although, I mean, talk about exploitation. Poor Ricky Lindholm is so unnecessarily topless for so much of this movie.
Oh, Ricky.
Yeah, yeah. But everyone did a good job. And Sarah Paxton and Martha McIsaac, I don't want to skip over. They did great. Unfortunately, I don't remember Sad Boy Son.
I don't know who that would have been, but maybe he doesn't need a name. Martha McIsaac and Sarah Paxton, for someone that just rewatched it, were their demises as brutal as the original? Because it was
brutal. Sarah Paxton doesn't die, which I don't love. She lives, which is like, ugh. And Sad Gross. Boy lives. So it's like they both make it to safety, which is a little lame to me.
Is it because he like kind of saved, because in the original he kind of saves her, right?
Yes, he kind of fails at saving her. He does give Daddy the gun. He gives Tony Goldwyn the gun.
Damn.
Which is nice. But yeah. So Martha McIsaac's death is pretty brutal. And honestly, the rape scene is, I was not expecting it to be as brutal as it was in this remake. It's really brutal. It's really long. It's really uncomfortable. So
that's like the one thing they didn't need to do.
I know. The one thing. No, they didn't kill her. They kept her alive.
Sarah Paxton's the one that gets assaulted. Oh.
Yes, she gets raped. Yeah, pretty brutally.
I guess that aligns with what happens in the characters in the Ridge. How does Martha McIsaac get it?
Well, she gets it just worse in general. Like she gets.
Murder. Yeah.
Yeah, I believe it's multiple stabs, like the last, like what finally gets her is like multiple stabs because she like talks Classic. Back to Garrett Dillahunt and is like, you're pathetic.
Oh,
or something.
Martha. Yeah. I've seen her in a live stage production of Our Town.
Wow.
Also,
well, unfortunately, she's not blonde, so she couldn't live.
That's true. That's true. And I think that oscillates every 10 years or so in horror. Either
Absolutely,
blonde you live or blonde you die. And it's one or the other. And I think right now we're in flux. Couldn't tell you. Well, we don't see blondes in cinema anymore. They don't exist. So. Like was there a single blonde in Scream 5 other than Judy Hicks and her son? I don't think so. I don't think there was.
No, but if you go that far, I mean, we hit Midsommar, we get Flossie, we get Tony with Hereditary, we get some blondes, not too far.
I don't know
back.
If I want to count A24. I don't know if I'm gonna. If
I don't
I'm
know
not,
if you I'm, get to decide that. Unfortunately,
I think that I do. So yeah, overall thoughts about this Rumook.
I mean, I feel like my
your analogy, which was hilarious, but not analogy, kind ultimately.
Not kind, and that's important, I think.
To the truth of the matter.
Listen, it did. I also want to say, and no shade to Martha McIsaac, because never. I think she did a fine job in this. I think she really did a good job. I do think the movie starts to sail once she dies.
well, good for, that's good for her. Oh, no, reverse of good for her. That's bad for her.
Reverse of good for her. Although she was super charming. Again, not a knock against her. It was more so a pacing thing. It also was funny to me, just because of when we're watching this, how much more of a summer movie this one is. Like, it's very like, this is our lake house that we go to for the summer.
Did you see in my outline how I spelled Martha McIsaac?
Yeah, I did.
I literally was like not looking and I didn't go back because you're so close, so much, my friend. I thought she gets a trash outline and that's what I gave you.
I love it.
Thank
I'm
you.
I'm here for your trash.
Kind of wish I had rewatched it, but that's okay. I rewatched the original because I hadn't seen that since I was 12 and I feel bad. I don't feel worse. I don't feel better having watched it. I feel worse.
Really, eh? Damn.
No, I don't mean I like it less. I feel
no, I know. Worse. Emotionally.
I feel gross. Yeah. Which, you know what? I was not expecting that. I was expecting to think, this is from 1972. This movie is silly. No. It's gross.
That is what I will say. Like, and again, keeping in mind my, maybe it's a good movie, but not a good horror movie. Like, isn't that what seeing this is supposed to make you feel? It's uncomfortable. And yeah, I guess as I was watching the Sarah Paxton rape scene, which is also just as brutal, I won't say just as, because I've not seen the 70s one directly. So I don't want to directly compare them. I was definitely surprised by how brutal it was because I was expecting it to be much more toned down. Yeah. And then I guess I just would rather, if I'm being subjected to that, I would rather it fit in an overall package that is doing something, that is saying something a bit more. The fact that it's in this glossy Disney live action remake package is what like makes it so false to me.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, that sounds right. And that almost makes it a little bit more exploitative. Because it's trying to tone it down, but like, you know, if you're having a severe rape scene, but you have a reason for it, and there's
and it's thought about, behind it,
and
sorry.
Yeah, no, yeah, what are you saying?
Well, it's just about the crudeness. Like, it's about the cruel, like the cruelty is the point. In the way where, yeah. Like, it's not in this next movie, or it's trying not to be. Like, it's like she lives, but we're still going to see, like, Ricky Lindholm's boobs, like, unnecessarily for almost the entire movie. Like,
well, Rick.
I know. They look great, but
oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Love her. She's still got a strong happening genre career right now.
Absolutely, she does.
I only say that because of Knives Out, but. You know, that's enough. That is enough. Did you know, and for all the horror fans listening, they'll be well aware, but for you, the main villain here, his name is Krug Stylo. Does that sound familiar to you? Does that sound like the name of an other horror icon that we might be familiar with?
Oh, gosh. Krug? No.
Kruger?
Get it.
Yeah. Sorry. So another, the most... one of the most famous Wes Craven joints, Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy Krueger, Krug Stylo. This is just me trying to remember a fact I heard many years ago. So if it's wrong, just give me permission to be wrong. But I believe Wes Craven was bullied by a guy named Krueger, or had a bad relationship with someone by the name of Krug or Krueger, and just like your good friend Josh Coringa, all the real names make it into the scripts at some point or another.
This sounds familiar to me as well. So it is possible that I either heard it on your podcast or we both heard it on another podcast. But well, it sounds familiar to me too. So I'm with you.
Considering you don't listen to my podcast. No, wow, that's rude. I can't get into that now. No, no, no. And how dare anyone ever, what's the word?
Reference another podcast?
No, like, but like, need someone they know to listen to their podcast, because you're never, no one will, you know, will ever listen to your podcast. It's kind of just how it is.
That's the rule of podcasts.
It's the rule of podcasts. The only people listening are people you've never met. And I think that's beautiful. And I think that's okay. Although, weren't we in public? Was it yesterday? And I ran into someone from high school that knew about my podcast. Can you tell our listeners about that? Because that was kind of fun.
Yeah. We were having a less than successful venture to a public pool on a very hot day. And we saw someone who Josh knows from high school, yeah, who he hadn't seen in a long time. And it was just one of those beautiful moments where you say hi, and then the next thing that comes out of their mouth is, oh, my God, I hear you have an amazing podcast.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, everyone's talking about my amazing podcast, are they? Maybe they're just making fun of it. How dare you make fun of my podcast?
I'm sure that's it.
If who's Sarah Paxton and who's Martha McIsaac of the two of us?
Of the two of us?
I think I know, but I think
I mean, it's less kind to me that I'm the Sarah Paxton. It's like, what? Why? I have nice eyes and I can swim. Like,
and you're blonde.
And I'm blonde, but I'm already blonde.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. Exactly. It's part of the package.
Yeah,
I guess. I'm the Martha McIsaac because I have done the after school programs at Soul Pepper in Toronto. So.
Yes.
It adds up.
You're a comic relief brunette.
I am a comic relief. Yes, I am. All right, Samantha, would you mind if we get into the grand reason why we're all gathered around the campfire today? Last House on the Left, part two.
I would love that.
There was going to be a sequel to Wes Craven's Last House on the Left. And I think the gist of it was we were going to see the main villain, Krug Stilo or Stilo. He was going to be revived from the dead. He was going to come back from hell and he was going to stalk a summer camp. And I believe that was kind of the main gist of what one of the iterations that was going to float around out there. How do we feel about a supernatural take on this very natural story?
Well, I can see why the sequel wasn't explored beyond the script phase. I will say that. I mean, like, all of my things that I appreciated about this movie would absolutely go completely out the window with this. Like, it does not need to be a yeah, of course. But it doesn't need to be that. It can, that can be, I mean... Yes,
no, I love that. I love that.
You love that? I do not.
I think that's silly. It's stupid. It's fun. It's wild. It's outrageous.
I love silly and stupid, but I don't know if I need this course killer who's not a lick of fun, who's just doing like brutal, chaotic murder. I don't know if I need him to be reanimated personally. I feel like that the whole thing of this is like the chaos of this just happening, right? And you not being able to do anything. And I feel like having then making it this like supernatural killer completely, it would be a completely different thing, which is mm-hmm. I'm just glad that Wes Craven got to scratch that itch in other ways. I will say that.
I agree. Although I think, you know, the one way it would have been successful is if they completely revamped the tone. And I don't know if that's the route that they were going to go, but we're going to get into it a little bit more right now. So yeah, the idea of a sequel was generally proposed as bringing back Krug as our lead, as our main antagonist. He was played by the great David Hess, who of course is murdered in the very final moments with a chainsaw, and it's a pretty spectacular death. And the rest of the gang are pretty much dead as well, which is going to make it difficult to bring back these villains for a sequel, but they were trying to think of ways to make it happen. So back in the 1980s, Vestron Pictures, they don't exist anymore, but they were the ones behind Last House on the Left, hired another pornography director by the name of Danny Steinman. So this is the horror hero that also directed Friday the 13th Part 5, A New Beginning, to write and direct The Last House on the Left Part 2. Danny Steinman, for horror fans, you guys already know, directed probably what is, for most people, the worst entry in the Friday the 13th canon. A lot of people hate Friday the 13th 5 because the ultimate twist is that it's not really Jason as the killer, it's some other dude in the Jason mask. And I think that really rubbed people the wrong way. People felt a little, I don't know, hurt by that. But I think
is that one your fave? I forget which one's your fave.
My fave is number 6, which I do believe is actually a general favorite amongst fans. But
how unlike you.
I know. Thank you. But part 5, generally hated. And I have to say, I don't like it either. And it has nothing to do with the twist ending. Personally, I don't care so much about the twist. It's just not a very well-made film. Danny Steinman, in my opinion, not so much a man of vision, but rest in peace. We're grateful for the work that you have provided us. And like Wes Craven, came from a background in pornography. So kind of an interesting, appropriate choice to continue The Last House on the Left lineage, I suppose.
Indeed.
So there were a couple of concepts floating around over the years, and none of them obviously came to fruition, but there was a really interesting article from, I think, back in 2016 on Blumhouse.com, and they had a journalist by the name of Steven Scarlatta, and he had done a piece for Last House on the Left Part 2, which is where we're going to get a lot of our information today. And there's a lot of really cool stuff out there. Something that I found interesting and I related to is one of the reasons this journalist was so fascinated with unearthing Last House on the Left Part 2 is because he had encountered promotional materials for the film. And I had as well. And so this guy, and myself as included, kind of lived a lot of our early childhood horror lives believing that Last House on the Left Part 2 did exist in some form of another. But ultimately, it does not. Yeah, it's super mysterious, and it probably fucked with a lot of people's heads because there was no internet at the time. But Vestron put out this, I guess, like a cut down version of Last House on the Left on VHS, and at the end of it there was like a little promo for Last House on the Left Part 2 just saying like coming soon or something like that.
We got a little bit of a sizz.
And not only that, but there were like posters seen, so there were materials for this film floating around the ether. They were really intending to make it, but it just kind of never happened. In a book titled Beyond Fear, we have an interesting quote where it gave a little bit of insight to Craven's involvement with the sequel. And it said, Craven initially planned to write a sequel in which Krug and company returned from hell and resumed their killing spree, but he ultimately decided not to go there. In the book Screams and Nightmares, we have a quote that says, the director had his own idea for a sequel which involved Krug and company coming back from hell to continue the reign of terror, but ultimately he thought people weren't quite ready for that. What do you think? What do you think audiences in the early 80s would have responded to something like that? Do you think people thought it was fun, or do you think we would have been horrified?
I mean, I guess I would say, given how the initial response for the film was, they probably were right that audiences were not ready for the comeback of Krug. Although they were, obviously, in Kruger form a few years later. But yeah, I think that they probably guessed right in that capacity. I don't know if we would have been, honestly, because of the same reasons that you brought up earlier, like this is not a charismatic. They make him a little more charismatic in the remake, I think, but this is not like a charismatic villain that you want to root for. So I think they would have had a really hard time making that transition.
It would have been weird. I think I think a lot of people would not know what to expect with something like that, and I'm not sure if audiences would have been flocking to a sequel for this, even though the first one did do well. So I'm interested to know what it would have been like. There was an author by the name of Joseph Madry who had interviewed both Wes Craven and Sean Cunningham a number of times over the years. And he did get some quotes potentially about Last House 2 And there was an interesting one from Cunningham. And I mentioned earlier, Cunningham is the man that was responsible for bringing us Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. And here's something he had to say about potentially bringing Krug back from hell. He said, I think we were both heavily into drugs at the time. I don't think there was any way to take that seriously. There would have been a serious consideration. Oh, there would not have been a serious consideration, at least not in the 70s, certainly. Hmm. So I think this is what it's saying to me is that, like, maybe they were tossing around ideas, but it kind of sounds like some people were never really that committed to bringing a sequel to the screen.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It sounds like under some substances, or on the influence of some substances, a few ideas sounded really great being tossed around, and probably, yeah, exactly as you said, about one person in that room tried to run with those ideas, and for everyone else, they just petered out right after that night.
I think so too. But as I said, they were going full hog by the 80s to get a sequel done. Wow. And so I was talking about how there was this Vestron cassette of Last House on the Left. Mm-hmm. And okay, so it did release a teaser trailer after the main feature. And I think you didn't see much because there was no footage actually shot, but there was a tagline. And can I read you the tagline for the Last House on the Left Part 2, what it would have been?
Absolutely.
The house that set the standard for terror, you won't believe your eyes.
Okay.
I mean, I'm intrigued, right? So I want to know more.
I think we could have gotten a second pass on that, a second set of eyes.
And the house that set the standard for terror, lowercase. You won't believe your eyes, caps. So
Wow. What
were they thinking?
You know what that reminds me of? On Who Weekly, the podcast, they've been talking about Hailey Bieber, her skincare line Rode, which has the perplexing tagline of "one of everything, really good." And it's just that kind of disjointed certainty that I'm hearing in this Last House on the Left 2 tagline.
I could not. Speaking of disjointed certainty, mm-hmm. did you see that interview with her and Gwyneth Paltrow?
I saw parts of it, yeah.
I didn't see it. I just saw headlines and I'm still laughing. Listen, I found Gwyneth Paltrow during...
Like this year?
Show that I, no.
Oh, no. The Politician, yes.
Yeah, The Politician is what brought me and Gwyneth Paltrow together. But better late than never.
Better late than never, absolutely.
Oh, and it's with What's His Name. That's too bad that it had to be What's His Name.
Ben Platt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know that Ben Platt was Ben Platt when I watched Ben Platt. You know what I mean? I think you do.
Yeah.
Craven has gone on record saying that there actually was a script that he wrote himself that little Mr. Danny Steinman didn't like. In a book out there by the name of Last House on the Left, The Making of a Cult Classic by Mr. David A. Zuklin, we got a quote. I wrote a script for producers, and it had Krug and Weasel coming back from hell, but he decided to go in a different direction. I'm just so flabbergasted by a universe where Danny Steinman said no to Wes Craven, because you're less I'm having a stroke. You're less enmeshed into the horror world, but Danny Steinman made one terrible film, and Wes Craven is the daddy of all horror. So how dare he? You know what I mean?
Well, maybe Steinman was in when he thought it was just Krug, but when he heard Weasel was coming back too, he said, no, too unrealistic. I won't have it.
I can't. Absolutely not. And was the son just named Junkie? I think he might have been, but I don't know. It was sad that the son was on drugs.
He gets a real name in the...
In the newsies?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good for him. Do you want to hear some potential names for Last House on the Left Part 2?
I would love to hear some.
So according to Steinman, there was going to be a couple of names on the docket, including Beyond the Last House on the Left and Last House on the Left 2. So what do we think of Beyond? What do we think of Beyond the Last House on the Left? How do we feel about that?
I mean... I get adding something to before the title. Maybe they should have added something like to the end, like last house on the left around the corner, or last house on the left. No, that's all I've got.
Down the road.
Last house on the left. Go around back. Going around back and leave the packages there.
Leave the order at the door, please.
Yes, please. Leave a door. Don't ring.
Please don't call. Thank you very much. What about last house on the right? What about first house on the left?
There's so many options. I feel like Beyond is true bottom of the barrel. We've got
three other directions. No, I like Beyond the last house on the left because it looks like you're at the end of the street. There are no more houses. I'm going in the woods.
Oh, I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Although wasn't the sequel supposed to be at a summer camp, which would not be Beyond the last house on the left. Unless that's really where the summer camp was.
Yeah, maybe it was. You don't know that it wasn't. In an interview with star David Hess, who does play Krug, he had some choice words for a couple of the different scripts that he laid his eyes on. And it made it seem like he maybe wasn't so disappointed that it never went to fruition. Can I give you the quote?
Mm-hmm.
I saw a couple of different scripts, and one was worse than the next. It kind of fizzled. At one time, they were going at setting it at summer camp. Danny Steinman and I had a lot of talks about it, and we didn't want to make it a straight slasher movie. We thought that once we got on set, we could work with it and make it more interesting. After all, it would seem to me that it would be really hard to make a sequel to Last House on the Left. I mean, how are you going to make it better? Huh. Doesn't sound like he was so into it. It sounds like he signed on, though. It sounds like he was going to get the money, honey.
Absolutely. You gotta. Okay. I have a way better pitch for this reanimated sequel. Why don't we reanimate our girlies?
That's so good.
Something to vindicate.
So the girl lives. So the evil woman lives, let's say.
Or they don't live. That was not what I was thinking.
No, I know that's not what you're saying. I'm going on to your pitch.
Yes, and me.
She lives somehow, okay? So she got away scot-free and is like...
Ricky is in the woods.
In the woods, new criminals, and like has like a new set of bad people that she's around.
Okay.
They resurrected and come back, and she is the target.
Yes. I love it.
Mm-hmm. I like it too. That's
we're passing genius. That Bechdel test, baby.
Oh yeah, the Bechdel test off the charts. Blown it up. Yeah, I love that, Samantha. That was a great pitch. Actually, I kinda wanna pitch that to the world now.
I know, me too. I'm into it.
And also I always want to explore the woman raping men themes. No, I'm cutting that out.
Some pig raping.
Yeah, why not? It's very 2022.
I mean, the Prince William's into it. So
Prince William's into being pegged.
Yeah, have you heard that? That's like the recent gossip as of like this weekend. Is that like being pegged by like this other woman who Kate was like, "It's fine, you can do this. I don't want to do it, so it's fine. But don't fall in love." And then guess what? He fell in love.
With Peggy Lee?
Peggy Lee. <Yeah.
laughs> I mean, it's kind of hot.
I mean, it's hot for them, I guess. Yeah.
I don't want to yuck the muck. Anyway. Samantha, my beautiful friend, my wonderful collaborator. Yes. Do you foresee a world? Do you envision a future where we may see a sequel to Last House on the Left?
Well, I think that we just have pitched here. We have a proof of concept. I mean,
okay, I have a title. Do you want to hear my title?
I want to hear your title.
Last House on the Left, Resurrection.
Wow. Simple, to the point. We got a colon in there, so we've got all the roads lead to success. Nope, that's not how that goes.
Jerome. And there's so many other wonderful resurrection horror sequels that we get to sort of live in the shadow of.
Yes, Halloween, being family.
Alien, The Matrix, Scream the TV show. Lots of resurrections out there.
Which Richard's sister do we get in this one, though? That's my question.
So you think that there's... Wait, wait. In a real world, okay, in the real world where we don't exist because we're fake, do you think we could see a sequel to Last House on the Left? Answer me honest.
No, unless it is like a... I mean, the 2009 remake tried to do it, its thing of like letting the ladies live. We're still going to rape them. We're still going to make them take their shirt off. But one of them, the most purest of them all, will live. And so I could see like that kind of thing being made again. I feel like we're kind of destined to make those mistakes again and again and again. But the only real sequel I could see is something like what we're suggesting, honestly, of like a true reversal. I don't personally think like this world is one where you can resurrect this villain of Krug and make him interesting enough to sustain a franchise.
No, I agree with you. Or we could pull an I Know It Till the Summer Part 3, where Krug is now like the legend of Krug, and he's like a visceral entity rather than...
I love that.
No. I mean, it didn't work.
And I know it's Scream too, right? Like they do Scream 2022.
No, I mean, like they did it in like a supernatural way.
Of course.
And on that note, Samantha, my friend, if you wanted to be found, where can people maybe find you on the internet?
Well, I post very irregularly, but if you do want to find me anywhere, I am at Samantha Reyes, R-E-Y-E-S, _ on Twitter and I believe Instagram. There might not be an underscore on there on Instagram, but you'll figure it out.
I think they will. I believe in them. And that was our episode today, everybody. I really hope you enjoyed it. Happy birthday to our king. We love you, Wes. And even though I lied to you last week and I said we were going to take a break, I didn't mean it. How could I leave you? I would be so sad. We're going to be back next week with a pretty special episode, and I'll see you then. Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.